We're talking about alien life, life in space, extraterrestrials, and how they would be if they were, if they are, and how we would find them. We're also talking a little bit about the Mars rover, which is sending back pictures as we speak. And that whole thing about a microphone on Mars was just sort of interesting to me.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a great idea to go up and listen, you know, use all of our senses to investigate the universe and not just cameras and not just, you know, spectrometers and other instruments. But, yeah, let's send up a microphone. Let's see what it sounds like up there.
If you know if that happens, it'll be digital sampled on every rap record that comes out from that point forward.
I hope so.
Do you think that what they were saying they would hear, like the equivalent of Martian thunder, is probably about the only thing you'd hear, that and some wind?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the only thing that we can expect with some certainty. It's the only thing we know we would hear. But, you know, I mean, exploration is about looking for the unexpected, and so I wouldn't be shocked if there were sounds on Mars that we didn't anticipate. I mean, we always find things we don't anticipate when we go to explore. That's a big part of, you know, that's the whole point, really. So we certainly could hear storms. We could hear wind. But who knows? You know, maybe we'd hear, well, I mean, possible that that's a way that we could detect life would be to hear the sound. But maybe there's also other kinds of physical phenomena that would make noises up there that we can't imagine what they'd sound like.
Okay, is Mars actually red? Like, if you get up close and personal, is the planet actually red? Or does it just appear red through your telescopes because of iron in the atmosphere or something else? Or is the dirt actually red like it is in Oklahoma?
No, it's red. It's red dirt. You know, we've sent lots of color cameras there, and we've done all kinds of tests. And that's one thing that, I mean, there's a lot of mysteries about Mars and a lot of questions that we can't answer with certainty. But I think that's one that we can. It really is red. And you mentioned iron, and that's a big part of what you're basically looking at, rust. It's not exactly rust, but it's iron-rich minerals, old, dried-out, rusty, iron-eroded rocks that give it that red color. And it's interesting that there's that red dust that seems to be spread out over everything around the entire planet. And even in the sky, you'll notice when these newer color pictures come back that the sky looks a little bit pink. And the reason is because that reddish dust is even up in the air, and it's given this kind of pink tint even to the light. But, yep, you know, there's a lot we don't know, but I think we can all agree that Mars is the red planet.
Well, we know that the Earth is about 6,000 years old. How old is Mars?
Well, wait a minute. You're trying to trip me up there because the Earth is a heck of a lot older than 6,000 years.
Okay.
I mean, you know, of course, it depends on who you listen to, but...
That was a little creationism joke for you there, Doc.
Maybe I'm just brainwashed by my geology teachers, but this somehow the number 4.5 billion sticks in my head as a reasonable estimate.
No. So what are we looking at for Mars? If Earth is 4.5 billion, Mars is...
You know what? It's exactly the same. As far as we can tell... And again, you know, maybe we'll be surprised by some maverick discovery that just takes all of our current theories and shows how, you know, ignorant we were back in the early 21st century. But as far as, you know, our current ideas about the formation of the solar system, which I have to say are pretty compelling. They make a lot of sense. They have a lot of support from several different sources of evidence. Our current idea has all the planets forming very quickly around the same time from this disk of debris that formed around the young sun, right as the sun was forming. So if we're right about our sort of whole notion of where the planets came from, then Earth and Mars are basically the same age. Now, I'm not talking about the age of surface features, you know, what you would see if you're walking around. I'm talking about the planets themselves, when they actually formed. But the surface of Mars is actually much older than the surface of Earth because geologically Mars is such a kind of dead world.
Yeah, there's no erosion or going on.
Exactly. Or, you know, there not much of anything has happened on Mars for a long time.
Does Mars have plate tectonics?
It doesn't. It probably did in the past. But, you know, plate tectonics takes a lot of heat, internal heat. The reason why Earth has this active geology is because it's hot inside. You know, It's churning around. It's like a lava lamp. Okay, that's what the Earth is like inside. You heard it here Dr. Grinspoon says the Earth is a lava lamp inside. Hmm. And Mars just doesn't have that lava lamp thing going on because it's cold. It's died out. In the past, it may have had plate tectonics, but because it's a smaller worlds tend to lose their heat over billions of years. And so there's just not that active geology on Mars. So as a consequence, the surface you're seeing is ancient. Most things that happened there happened a long, long time ago, billions of years. The only thing that's not true about is weather and wind. So there's stuff going on Mars today, but it's all related to the air moving around, not the rocks moving around from the inside like on Earth. Hmm.
Well, let me change the subject real quick here. We got a phone call we'll get to in just a second, but I want to take this opportunity, since we're discussing origins, to change the subject dramatically real quick. We're talking about the origin of the solar system, and even if you want to talk about the origin of the galaxy, and I've read all about these origins of how these you know, formations of stars and planets all came together, and I can buy most of that. And I'm okay with evolution, even though my religious creationism friends think that's, you know, Looney Tunes. Evolution makes a lot of sense.
They're entitled to their ridiculous ideas. Yeah. It's a free country.
But the Big Bang, dude, it doesn't make any sense at all. The Big Bang doesn't make a lick of sense. I read this book about plasma theory. Where do you stand on plasma theory versus the Big Bang?
Well, first of all, I'm not any more of a cosmologist than I am a cosmetologist. Okay?
Are you saying that you don't want to talk about it?
No, I'm not saying I don't want to talk about it. I'm just saying that anything I say you should take with a grain of salt because science today, unlike natural philosophy in the good old days, it's very fragmented and we're very specialized. And I do planets, you know, and I can dabble in cosmology and I have my ideas. And, you know, some of my best friends are cosmologists and, you know, I even know some cosmetologists. But the cosmologists are very committed to this Big Bang idea. And the evidence that they describe to me and that I see seems pretty compelling. For instance, there's what we call the 3-degree microwave background radiation, which is that in every direction in space, there's this very cool microwave radiation that is the universe is basically 3 degrees above absolute zero in every direction you look.
But that can be explained in plasma theory as well.
Well, people say it can, and, you know, from the best I can determine, The Big Bang is a good theory because it brings together a lot of current ideas under one umbrella and seems to be consistent. But, you know, I don't consider it, and some cosmologists would probably argue with me, but you get to things that are that abstract and that dependent upon interpretation of a lot of arcane data. And in a certain sense, I don't consider it completely proven. I consider it to be a good working theory about the universe. And one that makes a lot of sense to me, but it's different from something like saying, well, we know that Mars is red. I would say that we know that Mars is red in a way that we don't know that the Big Bang happened, if you get my drift.
Well, how big or small was the little pea thing that blew up and that's where it created everything?
That's the part I don't buy, by the way.
When I was like in junior high, and it was like it was smaller than a pea. Everything was like in a little compact little thing that would now be, you know, very, 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 very small to hold, you know, Jupiter and Saturn, not to mention Earth and everything else in the galaxy.
Right.
And that's the part that's just silly.
Well, it seems silly. You know, it's certainly counterintuitive. It's certainly mind-blowing. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's not true, just because it defies our common sense. You know, I mean, think about, you know, there was a time in the past when if you had told somebody the Earth might be round, they would say, that's ridiculous. Look at the Earth. It's flat, you know. Or if you had said that the Earth moves and the sun is, you know, that the Earth is moving around the sun, they would have said, that's ridiculous. You know, don't you have eyes? Are you an idiot to believe these fairy tales? So sometimes, with science, we learn things that turn out to be true that really defy our common sense. So I agree with you that the notion that, you know, that Saturn and Jupiter and you and me and, you know, the Elephant Man and Michael Jackson and, you know, whoever, that we're all, like, combined in something smaller than a pinhead at one point, not to mention all the other galaxies and everything, that we were all this tiny little thing smaller than a particle that we could even detect now, That seems completely absurd. I have to agree with that, but to me that doesn't mean it's not true necessarily.
Well, Dr. Grinspoon, what came after the Big Bang?
After the Big Bang, there was what they call an inflationary state.
Wrong! You're exactly wrong. Rob will tell you what came after the Big Bang.
Tell me, Rob. I want to know.
After the Big Bang, the big cigarette.
Well, but of course. But tell me, is that still going on? Is that like a multi-billion-year cigarette break?
Oh,
or was that
yeah. That's the biggest cigarette of all time. All right, let's go back to the phones. We're talking to David Grinspoon from NASA. We're talking about lonely planets and planets that aren't so lonely.
Cigarette.
Hello, is this Billy?
Hey, how you doing, Doc?
Welcome to the show, Billy.
Hey,
how
thanks
you,
a
Billy?
Lot. I have approximately 4 questions I'd like to ask.
Go for it.
Okay, well, I heard you guys talking about another rover is going to land later
right.
in the month, and I was wondering if it was going to go in the same area or if you guys are going to find a cooler place to put it.
We only have 2 landers, and so it's a vexing question of where do we put them down, because Mars is a big planet, it's a diverse planet, there's a lot of places we'd like to go. There was a whole selection process that's actually quite complex with committees, and first you try to make sure you're going to land in a safe place where the lander's not going to get destroyed. And then, as I mentioned earlier in the show, it has to be near enough the equator to get enough solar energy. There's other considerations like that. And then beyond that, you say, well, okay, if we have this whole huge part of Mars we can land in, what are the 2 most interesting places
that
we can learn the most?
The face is the most interesting place.
Yeah, well, we've already talked about that. The face would not be an easy place to land because it's rough.
You already talked about that.
That's the official NASA explanation. this first one landed in Gusev Crater, which we think is a dried-up lake bed. And the second one is going to land on the other side of Mars in this area called Meridiani Planum. And the reason why we picked that site is because there's some weird mineral deposits on the surface that, again, seem to possibly signify a place where there used to be liquid water. There's a mineral called hematite, which on Earth only forms in the presence of liquid water. And there's just this one weird patch on Mars where from orbit we see the spectral signature of hematite, and we want to go drive around there and say, hey, what's up with that? What is it with this location on Mars where it seems like there might have been water in the past? So that's what we're going to do with the second one.
Cool. And I was looking at some of the pictures that came back, the color pictures, and the pictures of the rocks, they look like landscaping stones. They're real smooth and polished. And how come that is?
Well, that's a good question. And
thank you.
Again, we've only had these pictures for less than 24 hours on Earth now, and so we haven't done a lot of detailed scientific analysis. But it appears to me like probably those are basically cobbles that have been rounded by the wind. Remember, there's heavy winds on Mars, and there's all this dust blowing around. So everything's sitting there getting slowly sandblasted over the years. So, those round rocks in those images, and again, I can tell you how to find those on the net if you haven't seen them. The pictures are really cool. The round rocks, they look intriguingly like what you'd see on a seashore that was carved by water, but probably in this case, what we're seeing is the action of wind and the way that wind can kind of scour and slowly round rocks. And that, if I had to guess at this early point in the mission, that would be I'd put money on it being wind that had made those round rocks.
Okay. And you were talking about the Soviets earlier. What are they doing in space now? Are they still good at anything, or did we fully kick their butt?
Well, the Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore.
Well, you know what I mean.
So they're not doing too much. But the Russians, they're trying. Russia has such tough economic problems right now. You think things are bad here with the unemployment rate or whatever. If you moved to Russia, you'd find that it was a lot worse right now. And they're... space program has had a lot of trouble, and their space scientists have had a lot of trouble maintaining funding, even keeping their jobs, just even basic expenses. However, they of course have a proud tradition they have, a space program to be very proud of the accomplishments in planetary exploration and in orbital missions and so forth. And they're still cooking along, and they're doing a lot of international cooperation. In fact, the Beagle 2 Mars mission, the European Space Agency and the Mars Express, those were launched on a Russian rocket. And in fact, the Russian rockets are really good and relatively cheap because of, the differences in the economy. You can get a Russian launch for a pretty good deal right now. So a lot of European missions and other missions are actually being launched on Russian rockets. And the Russian scientists are participating in a lot of the European missions and in some of the American missions. So in terms of the brain trust, they're still involved. But there are not a lot of new Russian spacecraft going up right now, just simply because of the economy. Although, they're not giving up. They've got some plans, and they still have a program, and hopefully their economy will start doing better, and they'll be able to sort of keep the dream alive over there. But it's been lean times for them.
But even if they help us take a trip to Mars, we still get to keep all the good stuff, right?
Well, yeah, of course, because that's the American way.
Do you have any more questions, Billy?
I was also wondering if he wants to talk about the comet dust, and I'll hang up and listen to his reply.
Yeah, well, that's actually a very cool...
Okay, bye.
Thanks, Billy.
What he's talking about is something very cool, which, could potentially be overshadowed by all of our excitement about being back on Mars with this successful landing, which is that on Friday, the day before the Mars landing, a really cool spaceship had a great success. And that's something called a mission called Stardust, which on Friday flew right through the tail of a comet called Vilt 2. And Stardust actually picked up some material picked up some comet dust, and it's bringing it back to Earth, and it's going to land it in a capsule in Utah in 2006.
And then we're all going to get sick and the entire planet will die.
Yeah, exactly. You've seen the Andromeda strain then.
Mm-hmm. Are they going to quarantine the spaceship when it lands in Utah?
They are actually they're still working on the plan for that. Because it's comet dust, they're not being real strict and taking it real seriously.
And because it's landing in Utah and they don't care about the Mormons,
exactly.
I know.
It would just be Utah. There's not that many people that... No, not really. But actually, it's sort of a test for the Martian sample returns that we want to do sometime in the next decade or so. And when that happens, there's going to be a lot of very careful quarantining. It's the Mars sample that we're a little bit more planning on being careful with, strictly speaking, than this comet sample. Nobody's really that worried about, because the environment of a comet in interplanetary space is so extreme, it's pretty hard for us to imagine something living there. Although, of course, we've been wrong before about many things, so you always got to be cautious when making absolute statements about things that are completely unknown, if you know what I'm saying.
Our guest is Dr. David Grinspoon of NASA. His website is called funkyscience.net. That's funkyscience.net. We can take some more phone calls, but there's a couple things I want to get to before we run out of time here, and we're getting to be about that time.
All right.
Phone line is 513-961-8900, and we welcome your calls. We spent so much time talking about Mars, there's two things I want to talk about that we haven't gotten to yet, and one of them is Europa. Tell us, what is Europa, and why do we want to go there?
Europa is a moon of Jupiter, and it's proving to be quite a remarkable place. We want to go there because we've got more and more evidence that has come in over the last couple of decades, and especially through a spacecraft called Galileo, which was there for 5 or 6 years, and we just crashed purposefully into Jupiter earlier this year. The startling thing about Europa is that we're almost sure it's got a huge ocean of liquid water. The surface we see is ice, but as we look at that ice closer and closer, which we've been able to do with spacecraft, we see that it's all cracked and shifted and moved around, and it's apparently floating on liquid water beneath the ice. So we now actually think that Europa, this icy moon of Jupiter, has the solar system's largest ocean of liquid water. And if that's true, then of course we got to go there with submarines, and we got to look for life, because as we were discussing earlier, even, you know, though maybe it's our own ignorance at this point, we believe that water is an important requirement for life. It certainly is for our kind of life. If what we think we know about life is correct, then there should be life on Europa. So it's a great place to sort of go and test our notions of life. If there is no life on Europa, maybe we're wrong and we have to, go back to the drawing board. But it's definitely one of the places in our solar system that seems the most promising for finding some kind of life that's organic and loves water the way that Earth life does.
Besides Earth, of course, and Europa, what other celestial bodies within our own solar system appear to have actual water?
Well,
I mean, do all of them have a little bit of water?
If you include ice, then all of them have some, you know, tiny amount, but it can be really a very tiny amount on some of these dry, rocky moons, none to speak of. If you're talking about liquid water, then no. So there's a lot of moons and some planets that probably do not have one drop. However, there are a number that probably do. I mean, Earth, obviously, even though it's pretty darn cold out right here now in Colorado, has a lot of liquid water. Mars, if you go down to some depth, it gets hotter and hotter inside, just like Earth. And at some depth, there probably is liquid water underground somewhere on Mars, which, again, is another interesting thought when you think about possible life in some of the hidden parts of Mars. The gas giants, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, they have probably clouds of liquid water droplets. Venus also has clouds of water droplets. And, you know, maybe there could be some form of life that lives in clouds in condensed water that doesn't need a surface. And so that's why I don't think actually any of those planets, Venus, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, none of those can be completely ruled out for life, because they all have water clouds. And then you get to the ice worlds, like Europa has water inside, we're virtually certain. And some of the other icy moons, like Ganymede and Callisto, and even places like the planet Pluto, which is ice on the outside. So a lot of these worlds might have layers of liquid water somewhere inside. So we have at least the prospect that you could have something living deep within all of these icy worlds.
Okay, back to Europa. Let's say we actually send a submarine to Europa, and it actually drills through the ice and gets to this supposedly, underground ocean, this planet-wide ocean that's supposedly under the ice. Wouldn't it be awful cold there? And what would heat it? And also, wouldn't it be awful dark underneath all that ice that it would have to drill through?
Well, yes and yes, but it might not be as cold as you think, because one of the big surprises when we started exploring the moons of Jupiter is that there's this internal heat source that's rather large on the inner moons that we didn't expect. And that's one of the cool things about exploration, is that we think we know something about the planets, about the solar system, and then we go there with spacecraft, and we always find stuff that we didn't expect and realize that there's physics and different kinds of processes going on that we didn't predict. And what's going on in the moons of Jupiter is that there's tides, huge tides, because the gravity of Jupiter is so freaking huge that it just twists the insides of the moons orbiting it and heats them up. And that's why Io, the innermost moon, is just a volcanic powerhouse. It's just squirting volcanoes everywhere you look, Io. It's incredibly energetic. And Europa has the same kind of thing going on inside, maybe a little bit less, but that's what would heat it, is that underneath the ocean there's a solid planet that probably has volcanic activity going on.
So it's like hot springs.
Hot springs, exactly. Just like on the ocean floor of the Earth, you find these places called hot smokers where there's creatures living off of the geothermal energy from these hot springs. Well, you could conceivably have creatures on Europa that are living off of hot springs. But you're right that it would be dark. There's not going to be much light, and anything that needs photosynthesis is not going to be very happy in the ocean of Europa.
What do you think the temperature is at the primary location on Europa that we would be looking for, some kind of jellyfish city?
Well, it's above the freezing point of water, so roughly speaking, it's above 0 Celsius or 32 Fahrenheit, but you know, which varies slightly with pressure. And it goes up from there, and getting to the bottom of the ocean, it could be, you know, I'm going to guess 10 or 20 degrees warmer than that. So, you know, it sounds cold, but it's certainly within a temperature range that there are plenty of creatures on Earth that would be comfortable in those waters.
The only planet, if it is a planet at all, that Earthlings have not sent a spaceship to is Pluto. Planet or not, what are the chances there's something living on Pluto?
Well, first of all, we do have a Pluto mission that that some of my colleagues at the Southwest Research Institute are involved in, and that puppy's going to launch in 2006, and it's going to make a short journey, and it'll be at Pluto by the year 2014. So
no, it can't get there that quick, can it?
It can, but
is it going to tesseract?
Fasten your seatbelts. We're
going. How's it going to get there that fast?
Well, it's going to swing by Jupiter in 2007, get a big slingshot effect, gravitational boost from Jupiter, and it's going to end up at Pluto in 2014.
Does it have warp drive?
No warp drive, but we wish. We're still working on that, but I'm not about to talk about that.
What about tesseract, folding space?
I'm not about to talk about that either.
You know you know about tesseract, though, right?
Yeah.
All right, what do you think's at Pluto?
The question you asked about life on Pluto is a great one. You know, your standard response would probably, scientific response might be, well, no, it's too cold there, you couldn't have water, forget it. But there's two reasons why that might be wrong. One is, even if we restrict ourselves to the narrow-minded assumption that life needs water, it's possible that there is liquid water inside of Pluto. Pluto has this giant moon called Charon, and they orbit around each other very closely, and they heat each other's insides, just like Jupiter and its moons. And so Pluto might have a liquid water layer somewhere inside that could conceivably support some life form. But the other answer is that there's stuff going on Pluto that we don't understand. The atmosphere, even from Earth with our measly little telescopes at this distance, we can tell the atmosphere is changing, it's growing, it's shrinking. There's features on the surface that probably shift around. So there's some sort of complex activity on Pluto. And in my view, the thing life needs most is not necessarily water, if we try to remove ourselves from that Earth-centered assumption, but some kind of activity, some kind of flow, so there's an energy source. And so any place where we see some mysterious activity, like we see even at this great distance on Pluto, is a place where I think we shouldn't rule out life until we learn a lot more. And that's why we need to keep exploring.
If you were sitting on a beach on Pluto and it was a sunny day, how sunny would it be?
Not very. Okay, Pluto is 40 astronomical units from the Earth. It varies. It comes in and out, but it averages about 40. Now, an astronomical unit is the distance from Earth to the Sun. So it's 40 times as far away from the Sun as Earth. And since sunlight follows what we call an inverse square law, okay, I'm getting a little nerdy on you here now, but basically it means that you take that 40 and you multiply it by itself, and you get 1,600, and that's the amount of sunlight, is 1/1,600 on Pluto is what you would have on Earth. So, you know, and as far as sunblock you need there, I would give you the SPF about, you know, 0.00007 or something like that. So,
well, what would the sun look like? Would it be as bright as, say, Venus at dusk?
The sun from Pluto, that's an interesting question. Would it be as bright as Venus at dusk? I'm going to say, you know, if you're lucky, it's going to be that bright. To tell you the truth, I'd have to do a calculation, but it's going to be of that order. It's going to look like a bright planet, and it's going to look like a conspicuously bright star, but it's not going to look like what we're used to thinking of as the sun, you know, so bright that you can't keep looking at it.
Would it cast a shadow?
It probably would cast a shadow, but a very faint one. You know, even a lot of people don't know this, but Venus at its brightest casts a shadow. If you're in a really dark place, I was in a canyon once in New Mexico when Venus was at its brightest, and I saw my Venus shadow.
Yeah.
And by the way, speaking of Venus, everybody listening should go out and look tomorrow evening, the next few evenings. Venus is really bright right now in the west.
We saw it tonight.
Very conspicuous after sunset.
Yeah, it was beaming tonight.
Yeah, it's really remarkably bright right now in the west. And, Venus, by the way, is my second favorite planet.
I thought it was your first favorite planet.
No, that's Earth.
Oh, because you wrote a whole book about Venus once.
I did, and I've never written a book about Earth, but I really like it here.
You know, and no, I don't think anyone else ever wrote a whole book about Venus except for you. There's a million books about Mars.
Yeah, Venus is neglected and underrated. As excited as I am about Mars, and right now is a very exciting time, Venus is a very cool place, very unusual, very mysterious, and it doesn't get enough respect.
Okay. Well, moving along our solar system here, because I'm asking about all the, I'm trying to cover, we talked about Mars for, you know, an hour and a half. Now I'm trying to hit some of these other places. Do you think there's life on the sun?
Do I think there's life on the sun?
And either I didn't get to that chapter yet, or you really didn't discuss the sun much in your book.
Well, I make some passing references to it. I actually think there could be life on a star. If you ask me, could there be our kind of life, the answer is obvious. No, you know.
It'd be like flame men. It'd be like the mysterious flame men of sun.
Exactly. You couldn't have anything based on carbon. You couldn't even have anything based on chemical bonds. Okay?
Rob is looking at me like...
It can't be chemistry. But I could imagine if you define life as some sort of complexity that can reproduce itself and become more complex, then, you know, why couldn't you have some sort of weird plasma interaction, weird electrical forces on the sun, creating some kind of complexity that's evolving and biological in just some form that we can't recognize yet. I don't rule that out entirely. You know, it's definitely more fringe than the other things we've been talking about this evening, but, you know, we have to be careful in saying what's impossible. Although I would also add that there's a great quote from Bertrand Russell where he says, when one admits that anything is possible, one must quickly add that some things are much less possible than others.
Mm-hmm.
Or something that, like that.
That Bertrand Russell, boy, he was really a card, wasn't he? Was he related to Nipsey?
That Bertrand Russell.
Okay. Hey, we're going to go back to the phones here. If you want to call in, we're only going to keep the good doctor about another 10 minutes or so. So call in to 961-8900 now. Hello, is that Frank?
Yeah.
Yo, Frank, what's up?
Yeah, I was thinking there was water and all that on Mars. A lot of people say that there's no life on there. Well, think about it. You know, if there was water, you know, there could have been vegetation, and you would think that the oxygen levels would be okay. I mean, was there life on there at one point? You know, that's the question. Well, there had to have been for there to be water there, right?
Well, that you're absolutely right, Frank. Is this Frank I'm speaking to?
Yeah.
I get the name right? Cool. Well, yeah, that is the question. If you had to name one question we're going to Mars to try to answer with these missions, that's it. Is, you know, what's up with the water? When was it there? How long ago was it there?
And how did it get there?
Where did it go? And what does it mean about the possibility of life?
Yeah.
Now, the one thing you said about the oxygen level, actually, that's not true. The oxygen level on Mars is very, very low. The atmosphere is almost entirely carbon dioxide. So we couldn't breathe that air. But, you know, there's certain kinds of creatures on Earth that do use carbon dioxide. I mean, plants, for instance. All plants basically breathe carbon dioxide and emit oxygen. So that would mean our kind of life wouldn't be happy with the atmosphere, but something else could. So, you know, the other thing to remember is that these signs of water are very ancient.
Oh, yeah.
Most of what we see are signs that Mars had water billions of years ago. So what we think is that probably the climate at that time was more conducive to liquid water, and yeah, there could have been life there. Absolutely, that's what we're going to test, and that's why we're all so fascinated with Mars, because it seems like a place where maybe we'll find some ancient fossils.
I was wondering too, when it gets back with the samples and whatnot, I was thinking maybe we could possibly do some kind of test to prove if the H2O between the planet and our planet could somehow, if we can cultivate that and see if we can't produce the oxygen, and if so, do you think we can cultivate on Mars?
Oh, so what you're asking about is what people, I think what you're asking about is what people call terraforming.
Yeah.
Could we sort of engineer Mars to make it more like Earth? Is that what you're asking me?
By oxygen levels, of course, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think probably in the long run, at some time in the distant future, we probably could. It wouldn't be easy. It's not easy to transform a planet. And then, of course, there's all kinds of tricky ethical questions of
Yeah, why don't we just quit polluting this one first, and then let's not worry about screwing up another one after we just quit screwing this one up.
Well, exactly. But see, that's why I actually kind of like, there's a lot of people that advocate terraforming Mars. And, you know, my position is, well, what's the hurry? Because, like you say, we got a lot to learn here. But the mental exercise of thinking about how we would go about terraforming Mars is actually really good, because it gets us thinking about how do you manage a global atmosphere, a global climate, a global environment. Anything that can help us with the daunting task that, you know, that we still need to learn to manage of how do we keep from screwing up our own atmosphere. So in a certain sense, it's the same problem. You know, how do we purposefully alter a planet's atmosphere and not inadvertently screw it up? So we start with Earth, and eventually, if we get it right, and if we learn that there really are no Martians that we'd be harming, then maybe someday we will terraform Mars and change its atmosphere into one with oxygen that we could breathe.
You get the Martian Willie Nelson, you get the Martian John Cougar Mellencamp, you get the Martian Neil Young.
Mars Aid.
You put them all in the Superdome on Mars, and then you have your big Mars Farm Aid.
Yeah, exactly. That's perfect.
Thanks for your call, Frank.
Yeah, tough guy.
We probably only got time for one more call here at the Chris and Rob Show. Our guest is Dr. David Grinspoon from NASA. His new book is Lonely Planets, and the phone number is 961-8900. And I'll tell you, the last topic that we haven't gotten to that I wanted to cover, and which there is not enough time in the rest of this program, is life outside the solar system. You got your Project SETI with their radio telescopes, and you got these observations of supposed planets orbiting other supposed stars. In a nutshell, give us a little overview about what's going on outside of our own solar system, David.
Well, the exciting thing about right now is that I can actually answer that question a little bit, whereas just a few years ago we didn't know anything about planets outside our solar system. I mean, I'm not talking about SETI now. I'm talking about real planets that we know about. And in just the last few years, we've actually discovered the first planets around other stars. We always thought they were out there, but now we know they are. As far as SETI, you know, we've been listening for signals now for 40 years, haven't heard a darn thing, and there's a lot of different interesting hypotheses as to why that may be. In fact, there's a whole section of my book, Lonely Planets, where I go into the possible answers to the question of where are they, why haven't they dropped us a line, why haven't we heard a signal? And, you know, the answers range from, well, we simply haven't listened to the right star yet, and maybe next year we'll hear a signal, to more exotic ideas like, well, maybe they're there and they're not using radio. Maybe they're there and they don't want us to know they're there, so they're deliberately hiding their existence from us. Maybe they're protecting us somehow. You know,
they have a cloaking device.
Possibilities.
Yeah, do you think they have a cloaking device?
Well, they may have something like that. I mean, the fact is, any aliens that we encounter are going to be millions of years probably more advanced than us, at least thousands of years more advanced than us technically, because we're such babies, right? We just invented technology. And
well, what's the chances that we're the first ones here and that everybody else is going to be behind us?
Yeah, maybe they're stupid and we're smart.
Yeah.
Well, the chances are, it's possible. I can't tell you it's impossible, but the chances are not good if you think about the time scale. Okay, let me just... The universe is 12 billion years old, right? And the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. And human beings have been around for about 50,000 years old. And we've had radio for about 50,000 years. And we've had radio telescopes for, you know, like 100 years or less. And so, you know, we're babies. And so anybody else that we meet, unless it's like, it's for the same reason that on the day that you're born, almost everybody you meet is going to be a lot older than you. For that same reason, any other civilization that we encounter is probably going to be around for much longer than we've been around. So therefore, it's very hard for us to say, you'll hear scientists say all the time, well, it's impossible that they could do this, it's impossible that they could do that, because that violates the laws of physics. But, you know, those are the laws of physics as understood by our primitive early 21st century science. So, sure, they might have cloaking devices. They might be walking around, you know, in the room where you guys are sitting right now, and studying you, and maybe they'll decide they want to leave and go study another planet because they're not even anything that interesting to them on Earth. But I think it's very, very, we have to be cautious when we say something is impossible for an alien to do because we are such babies in the cosmos.
You know, we have Dr. Seth Shostak from SETI on the program with some degree of regularity, and that's mostly because Frank Drake won't take our phone calls. But we do talk to Seth from time to time, and I always ask him, as we make more and more observations of these planets that we think are rotating around other neighboring stars nearby, why don't we point our radio telescope at those guys, especially the ones that look like they might be promising as far as we can tell from here?
Well, we haven't really found any yet that seem...
We're only finding big ones so far, right?
Yeah, see, we don't know how to find the Earth-like ones yet. And so, I mean, it would be... I mean, one of these times, just for the heck of it, we ought to listen to one of those systems. But the fact is, as far as our, you know, at least our prejudices about what kinds of solar systems would be ideal to create intelligent life, and admittedly, those prejudices are all based on extrapolations of ourselves, which maybe is not a good idea, but, you know, we haven't yet found something that sort of looks a lot like our solar system, as far as we can tell, with little Earth-like planets. You know, sometime in the next few years, we're going to start finding those Earth-sized planets, and we're going to find some that are in what we call the habitable zone, which is the distance from their star where there could be liquid water on the surface. And it's going to be real interesting to listen to some of those for signals. I mean, why not? That's something we'll do for sure. But this whole business of finding planets is really in its infancy, and we're not very good at it yet, even though it's exciting we can do it at all. And we haven't found the Earth-like planets yet. But, you know, mark my words, in a few years we're going to start finding them. And sure, we'll listen. We'll see if they're sending us.
Let's take another phone call. This will probably be the last call of the night unless the next show doesn't show up.
I'm hoping that we actually hear from a Martian in this call.
I think we're going to hear from a female for the first time tonight. Hi, Carolyn. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. I love the listening. And I want, my question is, if he had to choose where the money will be spent, and if you could only vote for one or the other, would you vote for manned space flight or remote control robots and radio telescopes?
Well, that's a tough question. If I really had to choose, one or the other, that's it. You can't do...
Right.
If you choose one, you can't do any of the other.
Let's just say we're going to war again. We got to spend, you know, money. Just, we don't have that much money to do both. What would you choose between?
Well, if we were going to war with the Martians,
what?
No, that's not what you're talking about.
No.
I'm going to cop out a little bit and say, if you're talking the near term, say the next decade, I would say, let's do it all unmanned.
Unmanned?
If we had a certain amount of, let's send machines. If we had a certain amount of money, we could do so much more in terms of what we learn.
Right. I mean, how much have we learned from manned space flights when you add it all up? What really has science?
Well, we've learned. Okay, what? I'm gonna. You know, we've learned a lot. Apollo, even though Apollo was not done for science, it was done for, you know, it was saber rattling really in the Cold War. We learned a lot of science from Apollo, from the Apollo moon missions, okay? The rocks they brought back, the other experiments they did. So I'm not going to, you know, join this bandwagon and put down the manned space program and say it's useless. It's not useless. We've learned a lot of science. But, you know, the main reason to put humans into space is not for science. It's for something else. It's for exploration. It's for, you know, sort of boldly going where no one has gone before and all that, you know, and to me, that's not useless. There's a value to that, but it's not a scientific value. And I also think that eventually putting humans on Mars will be very useful scientifically because, a human being walking around with a rock hammer, a trained geologist making decisions about what to pay attention to and what to study and making judgments can do better than a machine in a lot of ways, but it's much more expensive to send people. So if you gave me a certain amount of money for the next decade and said, you can spend it on humans in space, you can spend it on robots, what are you going to do? As a scientist, I'm going to spend it on robots. But I'm not willing to say, let's never send humans, because both scientifically and then for all those other sort of spiritual reasons, if you will, I think there are reasons in the long run why we do want to send humans into space.
Well, it just seems like there's so much of a wonderful universe out there to explore. Why stick around here than solar system? And I'm just still more curious about life, real life out there.
Yeah, well, I mean, I share your curiosity, and I think if I understand what you're saying let's do it with machines because we can learn
and
a lot more.
Telescopes. Let's try to communicate or send something out.
Well, they're doing that, Carolyn. Don't think that they're not doing
it. I know,
that.
But there is a big... between the NASA people, I hear there's two departments, and there's jealousy between each, and I just would love somebody to write a book about that. I'd like to really read both sides.
Hey, you just gave me a good idea for my next book, Carolyn.
Oh, that's great. Come back. You ought to come back in February or talk to us again in February because we have birthdays coming up. We have Galileo and Copernicus in February. Galileo is the 15th and Copernicus is the 19th. So
how old is Copernicus going to be?
Oh, God.
500, right?
Jeez, man.
Wow.
That's pretty old.
What do you get a 500-year-old?
Wouldn't they be blowing their minds watching this TV right now? That little robot up there?
It is pretty mind-blowing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Have you seen the new color images they got up on the
web?
Yes,
I just can't believe it. I just can't imagine it. I think this is just, mine's so mind-boggling how they did that.
Well, I'm really glad to hear your excitement about it because, you know, it's like I'm immersed in this world where we're all just, like, drooling over this stuff. And so it's nice to hear,
I wish
you know,
they could
that extends out to other people as well.
I wish they could find a European craft. Didn't they come with a periscope or something? Look around.
All right, thanks a lot, Carolyn.
All right, bye.
Have a good night.
Thanks, bye.
Did Dr. Grinspoon,
hey,
I have to ask
you. Martian.
I have to ask you one more question before I turn you back over to Chris. Have you ever seen The Twilight Zone where the bus pulls into the diner and everybody on the bus is freaking out because they saw a UFO crash land and it says on the radio that it was the Martians, and the Martians have landed, and everybody on the bus is freaking out sitting in this diner. Have you seen that one?
I don't know. I don't remember.
Okay, but they're all freaking out, right?
Yeah.
And there's one guy who's not freaking out, and he's wearing his hat inside, which you don't do that. You know, back in the Twilight Zone days, you didn't wear your hat inside.
Right.
But he keeps his fedora on the whole time. And then everybody freaks out, and they say the Martians have landed. Everybody goes sprinting out of the diner. Go, ah! You know how Earthlings act when the Martians invade.
Oh, yeah. I've been there.
Yeah, they all run away. So the guy sitting at the diner with the hat on calmly and coolly takes off his hat and sets it on the counter, revealing under his hat a third eye.
Uh-oh.
And says to the short order cook or whatever, you know that news report is right. The Martians are here to colonize Earth. And the short order cook whips out his third arm and says, you're too late. The Venusians have already beat you.
Ah.
Have you never seen that one?
I haven't.
That's a good one. And if you're like eight, you won't sleep for a week.
Your description of it was so riveting. I think I'm not going to sleep for a week anyway.
Do you have any closing thoughts, David? I do think we should have you on the show again and maybe more often than we have in the last few years, as long as you're game for it and as long as we don't keep you for 2.5 hours.
I enjoy talking to you guys, and I enjoy talking to your callers, so I'm happy to come back anytime you want me. Closing thoughts.
Closing thought number one, buy my book. Closing thought number two,
well,
buy my
book,
other book.
Name the book, Lonely Planets, The Natural Philosophy of Alien Life, and then go out and get Venus Revealed, and then visit funkyscience.net.
Yeah, and also lonelyplanets.net is the one where you'll find the links to the Mars images and a lot of cool stuff about the book. My main closing thought is, of course, buy my book. But I will also add that it's a really exciting time to be talking about this stuff because, you know, the question of alien life and how our immediate neighborhood on Earth fits into the wider neighborhood of the solar system we live in is one that we've always been fascinated by. And what's happening right now is that we're learning new answers on a daily basis. And, you know, maybe we'll you know, the big prize, and some alien will wander across the field of view of the cameras and will answer the big question. But even in the absence of that, you know, we're chipping away at it, and we're actually expanding, you know, in a noticeable way our knowledge of the universe we live in, and you know, it's as much as it's a horrible time to be alive right now in some ways, this stuff makes it a wonderful time to be alive. And, you know, I'm happy that you guys are interested in talking about this stuff because I live and breathe it.
Well, we got to talk about it more often because we used to do this stuff more often, and then all this evil political stuff started happening, and we became aware of the conspiracies and the evil administrations and the fascism that's running rampant through our country. So we've been talking about that the last couple of years.
Yeah, well, that's important stuff, and I don't mean to discount that it and imply that it's not important, because it certainly is. But I think that you know, even in times like these, when there's all this like crazy evil and war and violence and things to be scared of, you know, we're human beings, and we got to retain our curiosity about the universe we live in. And in some way, the subject of alien life, I think, can actually be helpful. It can keep things in perspective and remind us that our differences and our problems on this little speck that we live on in the big universe are really pretty small and pretty petty. And the real story is cosmic evolution, you know, the evolution of the universe and the billions of years of evolution that we're just witnessing a tiny part of. And the, you know, the big question is, how do we fit into that? How unique are we? Are there other creatures out there that are on their own planets trying to get along and trying not to get themselves killed? You know, these are the questions that drive me, and these are the questions that I get to in the book Lonely Planets. And, you know, I think that it's useful for us to think about this stuff because it gives us a different kind of perspective on our problems that we have down here on Earth. Hey, thanks for having me, guys. I really enjoyed talking to you and your guest tonight.
You bet.